wrinkle is developing in the effort for defense acquisition reform. If the goal is to do away with cost overruns, acquisition policy may be beside the point. The Pentagon's getting ready to release a new analysis that purports to show that decades of different acquisition approaches haven't made much of a difference one way or the other. The one thing that has made a difference is whether budgets are rising or falling. Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu writes about it in this week's edition of Inside the Reporter's Notebook. Jared, good afternoon to you.
Very good afternoon.
Thank you. The idea of this is probably not that surprising to folks who have been tracking this throughout the years. Who's behind this effort, and what does it appear to be showing?
Well, the genesis of all of it actually was a very short paper last year by a researcher named David McNichol at the Institute for Defense Analyses. And what he wanted to do at the start of his study was to look at all the different acquisition reform regimes the Pentagon's been through since 1970 and see if he could draw any conclusions about what worked better in terms of keeping programs from spiraling out of control. And he concluded the answer is not really. You can't really draw any conclusions from policies. What does make a difference, though, it seems like, is whether the DoD budget is growing or shrinking at any given time. And it makes a huge difference. He's got a lot of other data points in his report, which we'll link to in the notebook. But the most dramatic one is that when we were cutting budgets in the 1990s, programs just blew up in cost compared to what they were supposed to spend, 50% on average. And then when you go to the post-9/11 period, when things are growing, it's down to 10% all of a sudden. And Kendall, Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, has really picked up that ball and run with it. That's why it's going to be a centerpiece of the report that we're going to see in a few months. He's mentioned the study a few times over the last few months, and now he says it's going to be the new big piece of analysis in that report, which has been issued the last couple of years. It's called the Performance of the Defense Acquisition System. And in one way, Francis, you could look at this all as very self-serving. I mean, Kendall is saying essentially, our analysis of history shows that no matter what you do throw at the system, Congress, the numbers really tell you that nothing ever really changes. So don't bother to reform us again. Just give us more money. But frankly, they're not there yet. They're not making that assertion that more money is the answer. Right now, they're pretty convinced that this correlation between tight budgets and bad program performance is really, really clear, and they're just trying to understand why that is. I'm not exactly sure if this is a preview of the report we're going to see, but Kendall says he has a few ideas about why that is.
It is that people don't want to let go, and so they've talked themselves into taking more risk. They fund more aggressively in the budget. Instead of taking things out and killing them, they keep them in, but they convince themselves they can do them cheaper, which they can't. Another thing that happens is instead of killing R&D programs, development programs, you stretch them out. You stretch them out a lot. And when you do that, you're carrying a lot of overhead. Your team isn't as stable. Your requirements are probably not as stable. There are a number of bad things that can come from that. The last thing that happens is industry is incentivized to take risk. I've sat in rooms with CEOs and looked at bids, and there's always this point in the process where the CEO looks at that number and says, I think we can do a little bit better here. You know, give me another 5%. Anyway, we're looking at all this. We're going to try to sort through it, but I think it's a very important analytical result to make this strong correlation, and it matters more than anything else.
Again, that's Frank Kendall speaking. That piece of tape was from a speech he gave to the National Defense Industrial Association a couple days ago. So obviously, the next question, Francis, is if there really is causation here and not just correlation, and I think that's what DoD is going to try to show in this upcoming report. So what do you do about it? I mean, the answer can't just be make sure the Defense Department's budget is always going up and everything's going to be fine in terms of keeping things on schedule and within cost. So it'll be interesting to see if the report makes any recommendations about what to do.
I took away maybe a little different angle or a different nuance from what Secretary Kendall was saying. I kind of boiled it down differently. I came up with the rhetorical question, why do programs cost more? With the answer potentially being because they can in times of more robust budgets. And when the budget is not as robust, they cost less because they have to. It's a different take on the way that you approached it. but maybe you wind up in the same with the same result.
I think your point is right, but it's a different point. So what we're talking about here is, so every program, especially large ACAT-1 large weapons systems, have an independent cost estimate that they start out with, and that they understand the requirements, they understand what they're going to ask contractors to do from the very outset. And in certain cases, those costs are not met, they're exceeded dramatically, and in other cases, they're exceeded not so dramatically. They're very rarely met,
right,
but they're exceeded not so dramatically. And the not so dramatically cases seem to happen, according to IDA's analysis and according to Kendall, what his team is finding, when budgets are growing as opposed to when they're contracting. So that's really the key piece here.
Has he said anything about potential ways around that issue of sitting down at the very end, knocking that last 5% off, and then having it added back on after a company's won the contract? I mean, it's not a quid pro quo like that. It's not necessarily a direct cause and effect, but that's essentially the outcome in many cases.
Yeah, no, he's not gotten there yet, but I think the main point he's making there is that when budgets are tight, everybody takes more risk, mm-hmm. including the government. The government overprograms, tries to stuff more stuff into a limited budget under the illusion that program managers can find magical ways to make things cost less. Companies are also chasing a limited number of defense dollars, so they think that they can also, through some kind of magical thinking, make their programs succeed with bids that are much lower than they actually need to perform under the contract. So that's the basic philosophy he's operating under here. I think we're going to get a lot more analytical detail rather than just his own suppositions in the next few months, and I'm really looking forward to reading that report.
I'm also looking forward to the potential reaction, either on the record or off the record, from members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff about some other comments that Secretary Kendall's made.
Yeah, so this is, we don't have much detail on this particular issue because there's no official bill introduced in Congress, but Senator John McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has made very clear that he wants a more, you know, full-throated voice from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the entire acquisition system. Remember, this is something that we kind of reversed back in 1986 with the Goldwater-Nichols Act, but the chiefs have indicated that they think they need a bigger role in acquisition. McCain thinks the same thing, and McCain has said that he's going to try to insert some provisions into this year's DoD authorization bill to give them just that. We don't know the details that yet. Kendall says he supports that up to a point, but he's also urging some caution here, because even in the post-Goldwater-Nichols era, he came up with some examples, such as in future combat systems, where even just the mere suggestions, even though they don't have legal authority, even just the mere suggestions from the service chiefs that things ought to be done in a certain way and meet certain timelines have taken things off the rails, as they did with FCS, which was eventually canceled by Bob Gates after spending $159 billion and getting really nothing other than some education about how not to run a program. Kendall says he does want the chiefs to play a greater role in some areas. One of those, as he explained to me in a conversation after his speech after NDIA this week, was that he wants them to really help develop the acquisition workforce, something that many observers from the outside have said that they have not done an adequate job of doing, especially when it comes to the military members in that acquisition workforce.
And acknowledge that we need top-notch professionals working in acquisition, and that they're very valued by their service to do that. Make sure that acquisition people and their career patterns are treated, you know, fairly and have good chances to advance. I want them to work with the acquisition community on requirements. Many times requirements can only be changed at a very senior level. So I want them to make sure that the senior level people are available to discuss requirements and make adjustments as necessary. And in that world, I want them to listen to people about what's technically feasible and realistic and affordable so they can make better judgments. And then in budgeting, I want them to help make sure that we have adequate budgets, that we don't allow people to insert too much unsupported optimism into the way they do budgeting.
Those all sound like things that don't require statutory change.
No, they don't. I think there is a perception, I need to talk to the chiefs more about this. I think there's a perception that they're excluded from acquisition more than they actually are. I think they don't need a statutory change. I can't recall when I've had a service chief come to a defense acquisition board meeting, but they're certainly welcome to do that. They're welcome to come in anytime. I value their advice on their programs.
So it's easy to hear that quote and say that this is someone who's trying to protect his turf. After all, Goldwater Nichols did set up his office in the first place and make the civilian leadership in the Pentagon in charge of acquisition. So you could understand why you would not want that to be re-intruded on by the Joint Chiefs once again. But as you heard, his main point is if the Chiefs want a bigger seat at the table, they have the avenues right now without legislation. So it's going to be interesting to see how this legislation plays out. But, you know, if someone as influential in the process as John McCain says that there is going to be legislation that reintroduces the Chiefs into the process, I think it's likely that they're going to have a bigger role one way or the other.
My colleague Jared Serbu, Federal News Radio's DOD reporter, going inside the reporter's notebook. You have a terrific piece in the notebook this week about the Army making force structured decisions at bases here in the United States. I commend folks to go and look at that at federalnewsradio.com. But two names now for jobs that have been open at the Defense Department for a long time. We're learning who the nominees are this week, Jared.
Yeah, that's right. Peter Levine, a longtime Capitol Hill staffer, most recently the staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee when it was still being led by Carl Levin before he retired in 2015, has been nominated by the president to be the deputy chief management officer for DOD. That's a position that's been empty since November of 2013 when Beth McGrath, who's appeared on your show many times, retired. That office has had an acting director, Dave Tillotson, since then. But he's been pretty busy, and he's taken a very active role along with another acting guy in the Pentagon, Terry Halverson, the acting DOD CIO. They've been leading a very extensive review of all of the Pentagon's business processes and IT spending, something called the Business Process and Systems Review. We're told that the results of that are going to be available within the next few weeks. So that's one position. The other one is John Conger, who's already well known in the Pentagon. He's sort of the point man on BRAC right now. I'm sure he's not sorry to leave that position behind. He's been nominated by the president to be the principal deputy undersecretary for comptroller, which is basically the Pentagon CFO. So assuming that the Senate consents to all that, that should happen within the next few months. One of the key questions is what happens to Conger's old position. He's been acting as the Pentagon's basically top installations official for the last 2 years when Dorothy Robine went over to GSA, and there's been no permanent Senate-confirmed official in that position ever since then. So this would seem like a good time, now that Conger's leaving, to officially nominate someone to that post.
We're going to see some reorg in the DCMO's office, because that office will be merged with Terry Halverson's office.
That's correct.
And even before we knew that was going to happen, we had almost complete turnover at the very top of the DCMO's office, because Beth retired and Dave Winogren, her assistant, retired, and Paul Brubaker, Dave didn't retire, but he left. And Paul Brubaker also left that office. So
right.
The DCMO leadership has changed considerably. Now it's about to not go away, I guess, but to transition in a number of different ways.
Right. So the change you're alluding to was a change in the Defense Authorization Bill for 2015, which ordered DOD to combine the CIO's office and the DCMO's office into a new Undersecretary for Management and Information Systems, I think it's called. It would become actually the number three position in DOD, a very big deal. But DOD's got a lot of time to think about it. It doesn't need to be in place until the end of fiscal year 2017. So in the meantime, it's important to fill these jobs as they exist right now. So I think that's why this Levine nomination is happening as it is.
I always love going inside the reporter's notebook. Thank you very much, my friend.
Thank you.